Welcome to Why Not Me, The World podcast, hosted by Tony Mantor. Broadcasting from Music City, USA, Nashville, Tennessee. Join us as our guests tell us their stories. Some will make you laugh, some will make you cry. Real life people who will inspire and show that you are not alone in this world. Hopefully, you gain more awareness, acceptance, and a better understanding for autism around the world. Hi, I'm Tony Mantor. Welcome to Why Not Me, The World. Today, our guest has such a story to tell. She has three autistic brothers. She's just written a book entitled, What Are You Looking At? Ali Carbone joins us today, and I'm just so happy to have her on the show. Thanks for coming on, Ali.
Of course. I'm excited to be here. This is my first ever podcast.
Wow, that's awesome. And I am truly humbled that you picked this one to be your first podcast. So let's jump into it. I understand that you have three brothers that are autistic.
Yes. Yes. I like to say, I always say hat trick when people ask me about my little situation. I went to like this sibling meetup a week ago. And she was like, oh, you have a brother on the spectrum. I was like, no, I got three. And the looks that I get from people when they hear that is always like such hard, it makes me laugh. Like I can't not, like every time, it's almost like if you had a really bad injury and you're like, oh yeah, I got it in a shark fight. Like I almost feel like that's the reaction I get every time I tell my story. But yeah, that's who I am. That's who I pride myself to be. And I think that's also kind of the preface of this book is that I consider myself the sister of three autistic brothers. I don't consider myself Ali Carbone.
That's really interesting. That's quite a story to tell, actually.
That's the jump off of my story, is that like my life has been lived for three other people. And that's a badge that I am very proud of, but have now, you know, I turned 32 years ago. I just turned 31, and I realized that maybe it wasn't a badge. Maybe it was a shield that I was trying to protect myself with. And I've realized that there is a large group of people out there that, you know, go through the same things that I do, and we're not spoken about because we're not the ones that, you know, we're not the disabled ones. We're not the ones that need the extra help. But ironically, when we're raised in these situations, we end up needing it.
So are you in a position now where you're still taking care of your brothers, or what's happening there?
No. So my three brothers are actually in two separate group homes. When I was end of sophomore year, going into junior year of college, three spots opened up in a children's residential program, probably like 15 minutes away from my parents' house. And it was like right on the beach, and it's through the school that they went through. And that's like super, super rare for three spots to open up. My youngest was 11 at the time, so obviously not ideal. My oldest was, what was he, like probably 16, 17. So like, you know, I was in college, he was probably 18. So it was becoming time for him to go into a group home anyway. And they called my mom and they said, you know, we have three spots in this house. Do you want to put them all in? So yeah, she took that opportunity because that basically guarantees them housing on Long Island for the rest of their lives.
So that must have been a pretty tough decision at the time.
It was really a decision that she made for me, because that's a children's program that they could only be there until they're 21. So my oldest, Michael, he was there for, you know, for 4 years. And then the two little ones, Anthony and Luke, were there for, you know, almost five. And now all three of them have officially aged out. My oldest, Michael, lives in one group home that's like 20 minutes south of my parents. And then the two littles moved into a group home that's actually like 45 minutes out east, a little further, but kept the exact same house with the exception of my oldest brother because he aged out years before them. Same housing manager, Not the same staff because it was so much further. But yes, all three of them are in group homes now. So I definitely have a different, I have a different experience than a lot of siblings. I think there are a lot of siblings that are, you know, they're responsible for the day-to-day care. I'm fortunate enough to have a mother that took, you know, that it wasn't a risk. It was another sacrifice, because think about how hard that must have been to put your 11-year-old baby in a group home. But she was also doing that for her, you know, her 18-year-old baby at the time, who she knew would not be able to handle all of that on her own.
Wow, that's pretty awesome of what she did for you, because a lot of people might not have been able to done that.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your brothers. You've got three of them, all autistic, and I'm sure that each one of them are unique to themselves.
I like to say that the spectrum is represented beautifully under my roof, because it really is. They all are on different levels. So Michael's 2 years younger than me, so that would make him, oh my God, he's almost turning 30. He's 29. Michael is complete. He's the lowest and the lowest, lowest functioning. So this is like also not like, this is a conversation. People don't like high functioning, low functioning labels. I was 6 years old when my brother, you know, or I was 4 years old when my oldest was diagnosed. So I don't know like the new terms, like this is how I refer to it, you know? Michael is the lowest functioning. So he's completely nonverbal. He is also completely blind and epileptic. The blindness didn't happen until 2008. So I was a sophomore in high school. So he, you know, would have been in middle school. Like my parents just noticed, like they would hand him things and he'd start like grabbing for it. Like, and it was like a slow progression, but because he's nonverbal, he can never say, "Hey guys, I can't see anything." And, you know, between neurologists and with him being nonverbal and so low functioning, it's so hard to get a doctor that'll see him, you know, that can examine him. Like Michael, my oldest, gets put under general anesthesia to have his teeth cleaned every year.
Wow. That's very rough and I'm sure just overwhelming for your parents, and you had to go through that as well. So you said you had every level pretty much covered. So how are the others?
So then Anthony is super verbal, super social, but has very, very bad OCD. So it like makes it very hard for him to function in this world, you know, like, he also is terrified of dogs. He loved dogs when I was younger, and I brought one of my best friend's puppies over to meet him, and he like nipped him in the eye. And ever since then, if he sees a bee, it's like he screams bloody murder. And like, I don't know what it's like for you in Nashville. In New York, everyone looks at dogs like children. So like, and especially I live in the city, you can't go to a restaurant without a dog being next to you. So like, I can't take my most social and most verbal brother pretty much anywhere because he's so terrified. And that's not, it's also not a dog person thing. He's got bad OCD. But, you know, he'll have a conversation with you. Like when you look at my social media, that's the one that I'm always sharing. He loves to sing. He loves to dance. He's a performer. He's dramatic. You know, he's the star of the show. And then you've got Luke, my baby, who is 2 years younger than Anthony. He is very, very smart, but he's not social and not like, he's verbal, but only when he wants to be. So like, if you ask him a question, he'll answer it for you, but he really likes to kind of do his own thing. He's definitely like a solid mix.
Okay, so you've got three brothers. Each one of them have been diagnosed autistic. So as you was growing up, was that discussed with you, and did you have to be told why your brothers were a little bit different from you? What were some of the conversations that might have gone on far as you understanding what autism is?
I wish that I could answer that for you, but I cannot. Like, it's in me. Like, we never had that conversation. It's funny. So like, when I started writing my book, I put together a book trailer because I crowdfunded like the money for to write it for production. So I'm going through all this old family footage that my dad sent me, old home videos, and peppered in there was Michael's diagnosis video. And it's the video that one of the therapists asked my parents to take of him displaying like tics, like early kind of signs. And you see in the video clip of me, like, I keep trying to get in front of the camera. I'm like, and you, my mom is getting frustrated and she's like, Allie, please. Like, and she's getting angry because they're trying to figure out what's wrong with my brother. Like, there was never a conversation with me. I mean, I was 4 years old. Maybe there was, I remember. But for me, I've always just been protector.
So basically, you grew up not knowing, but you knew they were different. But it still was one of those things that you didn't have to take and be explained to. You just accepted it and moved on.
And I wonder if that's because I didn't have any other typical siblings. Like, maybe if I had other typical siblings, it'd be like, well, why is this person and not this? But for me, it was just, okay, I'm here. This is what my brothers look like. This is what brothers are to me.
Well, that just shows you that basically you grew up where autism was the norm. It wasn't looked at completely different because you had to live it and be with it with your family.
Yes. Autism is normal. And I'll tell you, autism is so normal for me that I cannot look at a word that has A and U in it and not see the word autistic.
Wow, that's really good. That speaks very highly of the way that your brain functions as well. So here you are in high school trying to have a social life. And did you have any issues with anyone looking at your family a little bit different because you do have three autistic brothers? Or did everything just go along relatively smoothly?
Like, I definitely remember, like, there's one thing I have to say is that, like, regardless of my family situation, my house was the house that you went to hang out at. I don't know if that's because my parents wanted me to have, like, the most normal life as possible, or maybe, like, my house was filled with sensory toys and we had a big backyard with a pool because that was all, you know, good for the boys. But yeah, I mean, like, I definitely have one specific memory. Like, it was, I don't know, maybe it was like my 12th birthday party, 11, 12, maybe younger. It was my SpongeBob themed birthday party. And I remember I saw two of my girlfriends laughing at my brother, like flapping around doing his thing. And we were kids and like, I never said anything to them about it. But that's definitely something that stuck in my head. But, you know, a better story, actually, like one that I actually like made a difference with two of my best friends, one of my very, very best friend, her and I did a Euro trip together after college. And retard is a word that everyone, like my generation, millennials use retard as a descriptor in a way that boomers may have said, oh, that's gay. Like that was the word, right? And it didn't really affect me until, like, I used to use it myself. And then there's something kind of flipped. And so after college, you know, we're driving around and I'm in Europe with my two best friends and they just keep saying retarded. They keep saying retarded just in normal conversation. And I stopped them. And this was probably because I was overtired and just in a bad mood. We're in the fifth country by now. And I stopped them and I said, guys, you realize your best friend has three autistic brothers and you continuously use the word retarded. Like, would you call a Black person the N-word? No. Like, and from that moment on, those two people, I've never heard them say that word since.
That's a great story. So that just shows that all we have to do is give a little understanding and hopefully it can change people's minds a little bit. Now, with that said, going through high school and college, there's always, you know, certain people that tend to create problems, they tend to bully a little bit or just try and impose their will on others. Did you ever run into any situations like that at all?
I think, no. I definitely dealt with a lot of bullying, like, myself. Like, because I was, like, this Italian girl in a very Irish neighborhood at the time. So I was, like, darker and hairier and whatever. I definitely did have a lot of out in public situations where I had to fight people for my brothers, never around my friends. So like in my book, like the beginning of my book, like I talk a lot about like getting kicked out of the Pinocchio Cafe at Disney World because people were staring and I lost my mind and I screaming and I have, you know, of me fighting with two little girls at my beach house because they were pointing and laughing at my brothers. You know, I've had instances where my oldest Michael was having a meltdown in a diner and he headbutted me in the middle of the diner while I'm trying to get him out to the van and everyone's looking at him and pointing at him and I turn around and I start screaming at everyone else. Like I definitely have like, I'm always in defense mode. Like I'm always looking. I don't want to say I'm always looking for a fight, but I'm always ready to like confront like what feels like injustice. I hate being stared at. Like that's the, what are you looking at? You know?
Yeah. I get that. So we've covered what you've kind of went through during your formative years in high school and college, but you've got three brothers that are autistic, but you have parents that have three sons that are autistic. I know that you know, there's a difference between the mother and father. Lots of times the father will deal with it a little bit more internally. How does your mother handle that?
If you look at a picture of her license from like when Anthony was diagnosed, like she was completely gray, like wouldn't color her hair, like completely depressed. Like yes, it happens once, right? And then she's upset about Michael. And then she has another kid because she doesn't want me to be alone with Michael. And haha, joke's on you. He's autistic too. So now she's depressed. Shit, did I just do this again? And I'm giving my daughter more. And then she had Luke. That was a surprise, but thought, great, maybe this will be, you know, Allie's typical sibling. And again, so I think she had to go through it three times. It was never ending. And yeah, it affected me. Like I wrote in the book and I don't remember if it made it to publishing because I've read it so much that I can't remember what made it and what didn't. But like when I was younger, when I would come home, I would yell mom up the stairs. And if I didn't hear her, like if she didn't answer me, like I had a serious fear that I was going to find her hanging in her closet. That is a childhood memory that I have and it doesn't go away. And sometimes I wonder like, why did I feel like that? Like she was loving to me. Like my parents did not ignore me. They did not. I think it's just watching her, just feeling her sadness. Like I think I also like to say, like I call myself an empath. Like I have a hard time not embodying what people feel around me. And I think that's because of the environment that I was raised in. And it was hard for her. And it's an ongoing thing for her. She's to this day, like she's not just guilty about them now, especially with this book and like with me moving in the house and starting therapy, she's guilty about me. And it's just like never ending compounding sadness for her.
Wow, that's just a lot of weight to carry on anyone's shoulder. And I'm sure that she did the best that she could, given her situations.
This is where like the glass children conversation kind of comes into play. And like, I didn't learn about that term until after I wrote an entire book about being a glass child. And if you don't know what it is, a glass child is basically any person that's raised in a home with a special needs sibling. And a special needs sibling doesn't need to be disabled. It could be someone that's troubled, that has a drug addiction, that's sick. Anybody that's going to take, you know, more attention.
That's a lot to take, especially at a young age and being a kid.
There was really not a lot of room for me to be a kid. Like what I like to say, I describe my childhood, my family life as 3-on-3. I wasn't a kid. It was the three of us versus the three of them. It was always who's got Anthony, who's got Michael, who's got Luke. So yeah, that's kind of how it went. There was, I actually went back, my dad, the year that my brother lost his sight, my dad wrote a letter for Christmas to send out with our Christmas picture. And I read the blurb he wrote about me and he wrote that, you know, Allie, we're so proud of her. She's so responsible and, you know, she, she does, you know, her studies and her activities and her friends, all with little prodding for us, like, so responsible. Like, I think my biggest thing was that I had to, I don't want to say raise myself, because that's not fair to my parents, but I had to, you know, I had to be a third adult from the time I was probably 6 years old.
Well, it's a situation of where you like you said, 3 versus 3, you know, you have to stop and remember, you know, you're still a child, okay? But yet you're taking on all these responsibilities of an adult to help your parents with 3 kids that have issues, you know, in dealing with life.
Yeah. And like, even if it's not like the responsibility per se, like I, you know, I couldn't drive them, or I couldn't, you know, if I was too young, I couldn't stay home with them. But it's like that, it's that mental portion. Like, I had no innocence. Like, there was no sense of ignorance is bliss in my life. Like, I was not free. I was not free to grow and develop in my own brain without like the harsh, like without knowing like what life was like, you know? And I think that's what really did me in. It's not even like my parents had me wiping ass, which like, yeah, I definitely helped them go to the bathroom. I definitely would help get them ready. I definitely would do their meds if my parents needed. When I got older, I would drive them back and forth and do drop-offs to the group homes. But for me, the biggest impact was not being free to develop in my own mind as a kid. I was always ready for something bad to happen.
Yeah, that's really tough to take. And I'm sure that a lot of people that are listening to this can actually probably relate with you. So we've talked about everything that you've gone through. We've talked about your mom. And now, how was your dad with this?
My dad is the polar opposite of my mom, and he just deals with a smile. I like to call him Mr. It's All Good. Like he definitely, I'm sure he was sad, but I never saw him cry over it. I think my dad's way of dealing with it was being a very, very active partner. So like, my dad did the showers and got them ready for bed at night, and my dad did the lunches in the mornings. My mom did the notebooks, and my mom did the scheduling for the ABA, and my dad did the cooking. Like, it was very much a partnership. I think the way my dad dealt with it was by being the best possible partner he could to my mom, who he knew was going to steer the ship regardless. You know, there was never, yeah, there maybe also, I think how my dad dealt with it was also by throwing himself into me. Like, you know, daddy's little girl regardless. But I think he definitely knew that my mom couldn't show up to like my soccer game or like whatever games after school because she had to be home with the teachers for the boys. So like, I like to say that like the boys and I both had our own parental representatives. My mom was the boys, my dad was mine. But I am seeing now there's so much like that's coming, so much like healing and like just visibility that's coming out of this book, like my dad, especially my relationship with him. Like after he read it, he sent me a long message that there's just so much he didn't realize was going on. It's amazing that they're, and like they just celebrated their 36, they've been together for 36 years. They just celebrated their 31st, No, I'm lying. I think they just celebrated their 36th wedding anniversary, something like they've been together for like, and they're like in love. Like my dad calls her mama. They're always kissing. He's very, very affectionate. Like he wants to be around her. This is not a man that like stays at work to be away from his wife. Like they're very in love. And I think that's probably the only reason that our family survived.
That's a really great story, and I'm glad to hear it. I'm sure my listeners will be as well. So tell me a little bit about when you moved out and went on your own.
I moved out of my parents' house, and I realized, like, wow, I have no identity outside of my brothers and my family situation. Like, So I, you know, I go into a worse depression than I probably ever experienced in high school that I never really realized I was experiencing. And I'm trying to figure out, how can I find my happy again? And I was a dancer my whole life. Like, that was how, when my brothers were in after school sessions, when their ABA people were over, I was at cheerleading. And then I went to dance until 11 o'clock every night. And that's what kept me sane. That was for me. So I found a dance studio and I started dancing again. And I would go by myself to this class as like a 28-year-old. And this girl came up to me and she was like, "Hey, my name's Alana. Like, come sit with me." And we just became friends. And one night I was driving her home from dance and she told me that she was writing a poetry book. I told her, I was like, "What do you mean you're writing a book? Like, I've always wanted to write a book."
Well, that's a perfect segue. So let's talk about your book a little bit and give us a little insight on what it's about.
This book isn't about the boys. This book is about me. I feel like the biggest thing for me in writing this was that, and this is going to sound ironic, like, I wanted to give a voice to the voiceless. And in this situation, the voiceless is not my autistic brothers. They can't speak. It's like the siblings that we can speak, but we can't because there's other things going on that's more important. And I think that, like, it's so important for parents to, like, I almost, like, I say this book is for siblings, but I also feel like this book is for parents of anyone and educators, just that, like you need to pay attention to the people that don't necessarily seem like they need enough, because if someone takes a back seat in the future, they're going to need everything they didn't get, you know? And I'm learning that now. Like, I was at 6 years old, I was a 30-year-old. As a child, I was an adult. And now I am a full-blown adult and I feel like a child. Like, every bad thing that happens, like, my reactions, sometimes I feel like I'm having a tantrum. Sometimes I feel like I don't know how to deal with things. And it's because I was raised, my brain was trained in survival mode, you know? And, you know, and this isn't about, not even about parents. This is about community, right? Everyone says it takes a village to raise a kid, right? Where was the village for me? Like, you know, we had all these, I come from a very, very large Italian family, and bless them. Since this book has came out, I have gotten so many messages from aunts and uncles apologizing, you know, from like older people in my life for not seeing me or whatever. But like the times that I felt the most seen were like when the teachers were around, because they treated me like they wanted to know about my life. Like, they didn't talk to me about being a sister. They were like my person, you know? And I think like my book is about the village. It's about like, your friend has an autistic kid and a typical kid. Maybe you should spend some time with that typical kid once a month and make them feel like they're just as important. Because at the end of the day, your friend that has that disabled child needs to give that disabled child their attention. Help them.
That's great information. Now, I know some of our listeners that may not have autistic children do want to help. And they'll see someone with autistic children, but they just don't know how to help. So do you have any suggestions on how they can actually help them?
You can help by being normal and by like helping the typical people in those situations still have those typical experiences, you know? We went on one family vacation. Like, I think about like all my friends, they always used to go on family vacations. Like, if someone maybe would have invited me with their family, like my cousin, they took me on a cruise 1 year, like with their family. And I'll never forget that. Like, I have the greatest memories from that trip. Like, there's the smallest things, like when you think you don't know how to help, you do.
That's so good to hear. We've covered so many good things here today. So what's the number one thing that you'd like to have people remember?
My number one goal is to highlight the down, because everyone loves Anthony. He's the star. He's beautiful. He's got, you know, he loves to sing and dance and he loves to be on camera and talk, and he's a feel-good story. Nobody ever wants to talk about Michael.
Yeah, I get that. And I'm just so glad that we was able to cover everything that we could and just Thank you for coming on today. It's been a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Tony. I had such a great time.
Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to our show today. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. If you know anyone that would like to tell us their story, send them to tonymantor.com, contact, then they can give us their information so one day they may be a guest on our show. One more thing we ask, tell everyone, everywhere, about Why Not Me, the World, the conversations we're having, and the inspiration our guests give to everyone, everywhere, that you are not alone in this world.